Adventist Young Professionals presents the following breakout session as part of the 2025 Behold Convention. We hope you enjoy this session and the entire series of inspiring presentations.
Welcome, Alex Bryan, Walla University, where I serve as president.
And I do this every time I forget the microphone. So we've been wrestling in higher ed, just like every industry, over the implications of artificial intelligence, right? And we can dialogue about that with each other. I was fooling around, though, this morning, by the way. And so I have a relationship with ChatGPT, you know, my own account, and I've been working closely. I don't know if any of you... just confessing here to you. Yeah, I've been using ChatGPT. And so this morning I asked it, what's the best Thai restaurant in Houston? Because I'm a huge Thai food fan. And it told me, right? Exactly. It took 5 seconds and it said, I got to go to the street food Thai market, a local treasure with deeply authentic flavors, laid back charm. Or if I want an elevated dining experience, I could go to street to kitchen or to Songkran. And then it, of course, asked me if I wanted something else. I mean, you know this, right? I mean, it's just, but let's be honest, it's extraordinary. Like my grandparents, oh my goodness, they would have no idea what this was and the level of precision now. And then I asked, give me an outline for a talk on Adventist values and AI for young adults. Full disclosure, I use zero AI for this presentation, but I was struck. No, but I was like, I'm really curious what. And it was crazy. So this is all from, they gave me a title, Faith in the Future, Adventist Values in an AI-Driven World. I could have totally gone with that. Introduction, they said, you know, a hook, you know, which was similar to this hook here, I guess, and its relevance, its, you know, how Adventist values can guide us. A brief overview of AI, which I'm going to skip. If we had an hour and a half, I've got a great video I'm going to interview that kind of gives you a real sense of AI. And then check this out, though. The sanctity of life and creation. That's a very Adventist, like, this took 12 seconds this morning. It spit this back out. The sanctity of life and creation, truth and discernment. I mean, these are very Adventist, right? I mean, this is amazing. Human freedom and responsibility, community and service, hope in Christ's return, or eschatology. I mean, you got to give it its due. It just popped this out this morning. And then it laid out all the topics that I was supposed to cover with you, Sabbath and truth and justice. And anyway, I went through the whole thing and I'm like, I have to admit, it's incredible. And I did another one. I said, write a 75 word love. And I meant note, love note to my wife in my voice. And they spit this out. I might text this to her later. You know, which raises a really interesting question. What would you think if I just put this in a text and sent this to her as I'm leaving on the airport and I go back and see her? It's better than a greeting card, which does this something similar. This is where I am, like, and I've talked to some of my faculty about this. Question is, how would you feel if I started sending out emails to you that were like, you know, great job, love your work, you're always, you know, whatever it was, and I just was driving it like this? How would you feel? Yeah, no, but I mean, yes, please.
I'm getting used to this. I'm an engineer by training and a manager of people.
Yeah, it's on.
It's on.
And it's interesting because I had one of my employees, you know, kudos to him. He did his performance review and I know he didn't write it. I knew something else wrote it and it wasn't him, but it was good. The content was there, but I was like, I don't know if I really want him doing that.
Yeah. And we just reviewed 17 or 18 resumes with cover letters for, we have an open chaplain position, by the way, if you have any chaplain candidates at Walla University. And of course they all had letters, right? And some of them were just fabulous. And what do you think, right? You start to wonder, okay? So At any rate, I'm going to try to make a, I'm going to try to just get going here because I think we've got, so I'm making a couple of assumptions. If we had 2 hours together, which I wish we had 2 hours for this, the first is I would spend some time locking in that we know what we're talking about when we're talking about AI. I wish we had some time to go through that because I think it would help us. So I'm going to make an assumption that all of us in this room have a basic idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about AI or AGI, et cetera, right? That this is a level of intelligent computing power that fundamentally, it's not whether we're going to choose it or not, is going to upend everything. And I am not hyperbolic by nature with it is going to upend everything. By some estimates, 80% of all jobs are going to be completely, I mean, it is going to turn the world upside down. And it's not going to be, do we want to participate or not, is my point. It's coming. It's here. It's not here in 10 years. It's here now. And it is going to have tremendous impact. And we can talk about where this is good and where it's not, you know, there's some sense that every medication you take within 5 or 6 years will be specialized to you because of AI's capacity to get it right. Diseases that might go, I mean, there's all kinds of good and bad. My point is, we don't have time to embrace all that, but let's just, this thing is coming down the track. So I thought what I would do is just give you a few things we're thinking about higher ed, then we'll talk about it. And some, this is really more a talk about spirituality and values than it is AI. Does that make sense? In other words, we can have a fascinating discussion about how AI technically is going to change everything it is, which that this is really about, well, as an Adventist Christian, how should I think about this? Does that make sense? I'm a theologian. I want to go, how do I want my students, my faculty, how are we going to think about all this? Because we got to have some way to get our minds wrapped around it from a basic worldview standpoint. So, yeah, but anyway, job market completely turned upside down. So this is, you know, waiting in line for jobs. Needing 90 new gigawatts, did I get that right? A power to drive what's necessary. Massive environmental issues with just how much power is going to be required for it, which I think is the equivalent. I got an engineer here, but I think is the equivalent of 90 new nuclear facilities. Like it's an incredible amount of energy that's going to be required for this. Of course, all the scary stuff, and you may have seen when Ukraine hit Russia, what was it, a couple months ago? You tracking with me? With all of the drones, just incredibly scary stuff in terms of what can happen with drones now, that anybody with $600 could send out who knows what around the world. Because I mean, it pretty incredible stuff. And of course, then for my business, colleges and universities, just what's going to happen to the way that we learn. So knowledge of good and evil, Adventist leadership and artificial intelligence is what I've titled this. I always put my email and I'll put this up later because I love to connect with all of you. But here's some things I've been thinking about. One is we've been singing about this kind of thing for a while, Adventists, Daniel 12. Knowledge increases, men run to and fro. Now, that's probably, theologians think that's both reflecting on the prophecies of Daniel, but also general human intelligence. But nonetheless, it's interesting to me that this idea of increasing knowledge has been in the blood. Hassabis, who's British, is one of the leading thinkers. He works with Google's version of all of this. Argues we need great philosophers to come about, hopefully in the next 5-10 years, to understand the implications of this. So this guy is like world-class genius with AI on the cutting edge. But notice what he's saying here, which I think is interesting. He's talking about all the dangers of it, what's going to happen. And he's saying we need some great philosophers. Read theologians. Read careful moral thinkers. Are you with me? And we got to have them not in 50 years. He's saying we need them now. We need them now. We need people that are thinking deeply now, not about the technological angles here, but we need people that are thinking about the moral angles of all this, and we need them now, is what he's pleading for, which is really interesting. So here are some words I've been thinking about as an Adventist Christian, okay? Some words I want... And you can disagree with me, but here's some things that I've been thinking about. And the first word is science. and how is it that we think about science? So I'm going to remind you of a few things. Then we're going to talk about humanity, development, goodness, resistance, and God. So that'll be the run. These are the six words I've been thinking about. So let's start with science. Dallas Willard was a philosopher, Christian philosopher at USC, and he wrote the following. Christian philosopher at USC. At the literally mundane level, Jesus knew how to transform the molecular structure of water to make it wine. That knowledge also allowed him to take a few pieces of bread and some little fish and feed thousands of people. He could create matter from the energy that he knew how to access from the heavens right where he was. He knew how to transform the tissues of the human body from sickness to health and from death of life. He knew how to suspend gravity, interrupt weather patterns, eliminate unfruitful trees without saw or axe. He only needed a word. Surely he must be amused. I love this. Surely he must be amused at what Nobel Prizes are awarded for today. At these things, Jesus, all these things showed Jesus cognitive and practical mastery of every phase of reality, physical, moral, spiritual. Saying Jesus is Lord can mean little in practice for anyone who has to hesitate in saying Jesus is smart. He is not just nice, he is brilliant. He's the smartest man who's ever lived. Amen. And what Willard's point here is that the example of Jesus is of someone who demonstrates mastery and deep understanding over the physical world. He isn't just this spiritual figure that floats about. He demonstrates real intelligence when it comes to the scientific world. This is the example that we have in the Christian tradition. And of course, you may remember that Jesus was a very good clinician, for those of you that are in healthcare. These are all different parts of the body that he healed. And I'll remind you, he was clinically successful what percent of the time? 100% of the time. We don't think about that all the time. He actually was really good with human science. In addition, the Christians formed the first hospitals. So this, again, human science, we believe this is the first hospital in human history in the Eastern Empire in Caesarea. And then one of my favorite historical figures, Fabiola, a woman, a philanthropist, formed the first hospital in Rome, a follower of Jesus. Okay. So when you think about all the hospitals and healthcare in the world, it didn't come from the atheist. It's Christians. Do you know your history? I want to remind us our relationship to science. In addition, these communities of care, now we use the word church. This is a tremendous sociological innovation in the ancient world where you have these communities of people that come together. They care for each other physically, et cetera. None of this was going on in the ancient world, by the way. This was a tremendous innovation. When you think about the formation of deacons, deacons were not called to pick up the offering and check the thermostat on Sabbath morning. What were the deacons? A sophisticated, intelligent form of the distribution of food to people that weren't getting food, right? And food is medicine in that age. The first universities in the world, I'm reminding of you a few things. We believe this is the very first University of Bologna, almost a millennia ago. It's the creation of Christians. Higher education is not from the atheist or some. It's the invention of the Jesus movement. Although the Ivy League schools have gone off the rails to a fair degree, if you were to visit them, you would see these churches. All of them were formed with God at the center. They are the invention of Christians. And then, of course, you have Galileo. You think about the great architectural and engineering. There you go. Engineering works that Christians have contributed to in history. I like this here. The Christian image of God is that of a rational being who believes in human progress, more fully revealing himself as humans gain the capacity. This is Rodney Stark, by the way, the historian. The capacity to better understand. Moreover, because God is a rational being and the universe is his personal creation, it necessarily has a rational, lawful, stable structure awaiting increased human comprehension. This was the key to many intellectual undertakings, among them the rise of science. The so-called scientific revolution, he writes, has been misinterpreted by those wishing to assert an inherent conflict between religion and science. Some wonderful things were achieved in this era, but they were not produced by an eruption of secular thinking. Rather, these achievements were the culmination of many centuries of systematic progress by medieval scholastics, sustained by that uniquely 12th century Christian invention, the university. And then Stark concludes, not only were science and religion compatible, they were inseparable. The rise of science was achieved by deeply religious Christian scholars. I'm doing all this with you because the history of the Christian movement, which Adventism embraced fully, was that Christians have been about scientific and technological thinking, brothers and sisters. Ellen White embraced this idea wholeheartedly in starting educational and motivating the beginning of educational systems, of healthcare systems that were supposed to be operated at a very high level. Are you with me? Technology, science was the friend of Christianity. I'm going to skip through a couple of pieces here. But the first word when I think about AI and the way that Walwal University thinks needs to think about AI is technological advance is not something we instinctively run from. Technological advance, as we learn more about the world, is something Christians have always, when we had our heads screwed on straight and we're kind of operating out of the way of Jesus, always something that we weren't afraid of. So the first thing I want my faculty and staff to think about is we're not going to be like panicking over AI or any other kind of technological intelligence, because that's not what Christians do. That's not what Adventists do. We have always welcomed, because we believe God is the creator of all things and that God is smarter than that we lean into it. So the first thing I want to say is our relationship to science is we actually are behind it because we know who's the God of all science. So I'm not going to go, oh no, AI, I'm going to run. No. My disposition is that knowledge is something I embrace. Second, of course, the great fear with AI is that it is going to displace human beings. And I think this is where theologically we have to make sure we're on really solid ground. And I think the verse you go to is in Genesis, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. A human being is the pinnacle of God's creation that holds great value and is reflective of God. Now, anybody familiar with this young woman here? Ellen White? Yeah. So her comment on this verse, I think, is useful. So God created man in his own image. Male and female created he them. Here is clearly set forth the origin of the human race, and the divine record is so plainly stated that there is no occasion for erroneous conclusions. God created man in his own image. Here is no mystery. There is no ground for the supposition that man was evolved by slow degrees of development from the lower forms of animal or vegetable life. Such teaching lowers the great work of the Creator to the level of man's narrow earthly conceptions. Men are so intent upon excluding God from the sovereignty of the universe that they degrade man and defraud him of the dignity of his origin. The genealogy of our race, as given by inspiration, traces back to its origin, not to a line of developing germs, mollusks, and quadrupeds, but to the great Creator. Though formed from the dust, Adam was the son of God. What is she arguing there? Who is a human being? Who are you? Who am I? We are the creation of God created in his image. Does that make sense? Like, this is really critical. Where we aren't the accidental evolution of some material accident in the universe, that a human being is the ultimate creation of God at the very pinnacle. So all kinds of great creatures out there, and I will skip through some of what I would say about them, but the human being is unique. And what's most unique about the human being is this, and this is from Francis Jensen, a Harvard scholar. Our frontal lobes, that is in our brains, make up about 40% of the total volume, more than any other animal species. They're the seat of our ability to generate insight, judgment, abstraction, and planning. They're the source of self-awareness and our ability to assess dangers and risk. So we use this area of the brain to choose a course of action wisely. We humans don't have a lot else going for us other than our wile and wit. Our competitive edge is our ingenuity, brains over brawn. We are an incredibly sophisticated creation at a very high level. And of course, some of you will remember either because you went to medical school or you learned it in high school, but you'll remember this, right? DNA. And that far more sophisticated than a computer code, which is binary, is a living cell code, which has four components, not two. Watson and Crick, and how cells are formed and how the simplest cell in the body, the mycoplasma, is incredibly sophisticated. And this is the very simplest of the cells. And even Richard Dawkins, I love to quote the atheist and use them against themselves, by the way. It's one of my, but Dawkins, kind of the famous atheist of our generation, notes that one cell in the human body has enough information in it to fill 4,000 books of 500 pages. That's just a single cell in your body. And how many cells, I should ask my good physician here, how many cells are in the human body? Putting you on the spot. Yeah. Yeah. So, somewhere between 70 to 100 trillion cells, right? In the human body. So you walked in here today with a massive amount of intelligence teeming in your human body, more than we could ever wrap our minds around. And so a super intelligence is the only good explanation for the origin of life. Again, Dawkins, biology is the study of complex things. I love his, that appeared to have been designed for a purpose. Even he is kind of tipping his hand there. And similar quotes from Gates and Denton and Meyer. And I like to play this game here. Any Scrabble players in the room? Maybe a few. Oh, come on. It's a young adult thing, Alex. We're not old like you playing Scrabble. Yeah, so if I pulled out these tablets out of a bucket and said I'm going to pull them randomly, let's just say I just did this with you, and I'm just going to pull these out randomly, and I pull them out like this to say Pacific Northwest, where I'm from, PNW is the very best. How did that happen? It's a miracle. You would say I cheated, right? You would say, yeah, you, Alex, you rigged this. Because the odds would be too great, obviously. Well, indeed, 6.2 billion combinations just with those letters, right? And so you look at, you know, Mount Rushmore, and you say accident of some meteor accidentally smacking the mountain upside the head, or do you see intelligent design there, right? I mean, yeah, it's pretty obvious you're going to have to lean that way. Bag of bolts that fell from the heavens, or do you see engineering and science, right? Right. I mean, you kind of you see intelligent design there. What about these guys? Right. And there's really only two worldviews, really, by the way, only two major worldviews in on the globe. And one says that what you see right here is a complete material explosion and accident. And the other says that these are human beings created in the image of an intelligent and loving God. That's really what you're, those are your options. And so the second word I want to think about after science is I don't ever want to forget as we move into an age where AI is going to outthink us, friends. It is going to think faster. It is going to solve problems we can't solve. Trust that we're already here. I'm not willing to concede on this second point anything but that humanity must always be valued as the ultimate creation of God since the beginning. Yes.
Where do you think the knowledge of AI comes from?
Where does the knowledge of AI come from? Well, AI is only reflective of human knowledge because we're creating the tool. And our knowledge would be derivative of God's knowledge. So I would say God has gifted us with knowledge and we are pouring that into machines and AI. Would you agree with that?
I agree. But I just wonder, how do they add so much instant knowledge into the AI? Like, how is it just like any question you can ask it, it has it? You know, it's like, it's more than like, it's not done manually. It was all done automatically. And I have a thought, but I think it's a little too controversial.
Well, now, if you start by saying I have something controversial, but I can't say it, now we all want to hear it. I mean,
I want to know what you think first.
Well, what I think is we have all kinds of instruments and tools already that we've used. And, you know, there's an era, probably grandparents' generation, where to move from a slide rule to a calculator was atrocious. It was like immoral. Does that make sense? So, I mean, so part of it is I think that the tools are just getting faster and faster and smarter and smarter and able to solve problems. But that all is derivative of what a human gave it. Does that make sense? It didn't create anything on its own. And even generative AI, which is the great fear that it will create things on its own, even that is derivative. Does that make sense? Because its inception came from the knowledge of something else. But did you want to share your controversial idea? Or shall we wait? Okay. Oh, half the controversy. Well, this just got exciting.
So I believe that the knowledge of AI comes from like the brains of humans.
From the brains of
humans. You're right. And that it's directly being poured into AI.
Yeah.
It's live.
Well, yeah, it does come from the brains of humans. You know, conceptually, it certainly does. Even if you were here at the beginning, even the questions I posed to AI at the beginning around writing a love note to my wife in a restaurant in Houston and writing this talk, by the way, if you weren't here, I was teasing, asking it to write this presentation. All of that came from my input into the system. So I think you're asking a deeper metaphysical question that's, you know, making me sweat up here and get really nervous. But let me say, these are the words that I'm thinking about with higher education, at least. And I think for all of us, from an Adventist perspective, number one, we don't run from scientific knowledge, just go and panic, because that's not the Christian tradition. That's not the Adventist tradition. We've always been a group of people that valued intelligence. Second, the identity of a human being, I think, is really important never to sort of give up on. Just because I have tools in my life that are smarter or stronger than I am doesn't make me less. I have a pickup truck, by the way. It can carry a lot more than I can carry. Do you understand? That doesn't make it better than me. I've got an iPhone that does a lot of things better than I do, but that doesn't somehow make me less value than... I've got all kinds of tools in my house that do things I can't do. So I think even with AI, I'm not afraid of something that's stronger or faster than I am, because I have capabilities, even moral ones, that it's not capable of.
You know, to kind of reinforce that, so the AI model, and it is a model, can be wrong. It can have a faulty training data set that you're serving from with your question and prompting it, and it could spit something back that's totally erroneous or flawed in some way. And you're absolutely right. I think it's based on our humanity that we've put out there on the internet or in data sets.
Yeah, I think that's right. But the key thing for me here is the word derivative, which is no matter something's capabilities, whether it's my Toyota Tacoma truck, that is derivative of human intelligence that created this thing, even if it can do things that can far exceed. And I think keeping that is important. Next is, this is an educator, by the way, if any of you are in education, this one is what worries me. And most of my faculty are most worried about this, I think. And that's, what about human development? So this is where I work. My office is right behind those two windows underneath the clock. It's the third floor of the administration building where the president's office is. And every day that I'm there in town, I have a choice. Would you like to see my choice every day? Some of you know where I'm going with this. My choice is, one, to take the stairs right here, right? Or there's this nice elevator that's right over there. Every day I have this choice. Now, because I was raised the child of parents who were like, boys, we're taking the stairs. That's the healthy thing to do. So I usually take the stairs. But sometimes I have a load of things and I take the elevator. I think this becomes the core question, brothers and sisters, on development, which is, if I take the elevator for everything in life because the technology allows, how does that start to hurt me? Are you with me? Like, if I'm no longer using my brain to compute certain things, how am I getting enough exercise for those things so that I truly am not beginning to atrophy? You are all so young in this room. You have no idea what it was like when I would travel to Houston from a different like this, and I'd have to actually get a map out and figure out how to get to the hotel. That is completely atrophied, right? It's completely fallen away. It used to be that you had to do a lot of work when you were traveling to know where you were going. Now, I just type in the address and it's like, I don't even think about anything. So my question here is one of human development. How is it that I use the tools that are really effective to use without losing either the physical or mental or other capabilities that I need as a human being? So if my students, for example, our English professors are particularly worried about this, if they no longer have the ability to write, what are we going to do with that? Does that make, like, what happens when the tools write better than we, et cetera? Do I not use the tool anymore? Or do I figure out how do I accomplish both? How do I teach critical thinking? Does that, to me, this one picture illustrates a load of what we face with AI, which is when we, you know, my father-in-law would have said, Alex, you're not a real man. You don't change your own oil. You can hear it, right? Well, I'm man enough. Thank you very much. I'd rather pay $20 than have somebody change my oil. So, and that would be the very much, you got to take the stairs, that this stuff's all evil. I think that this picture illustrates this issue of development. And I'm going to pop through here really quick, but these issues around critical thinking, emotional intelligence, communication, resilience in the larger letters, those are going to be the real issues we face. It will not be what I would call our laboratories, which is specific courses of study. Everything in these smaller letterings right down here, and this would also include other activities on our campus, for example, everything under there is a lab. I've been talking to our math professors, our engineering professors. So much of the actual technical skill and knowledge is going to go away, friends. It's going to be dramatically changed. The students I'm training now, the actual technical things they're learning will be so different in a year, in 5 years, in 10. The enduring things are the larger things up here. Does that make sense? Those are the real issues that we need to consider, because we're going to fly planes differently. We're going to practice medicine. Everything is going to change dramatically. But there's deeper values behind it. And these are the things, by the way, that AI does not have. These are things, for the most part, that are truly human. And they go to those deeper moral questions. So I'm going to skip through some of these. Development. Goodness. People, I don't know, Dr. Brian, what are we going to do with AI and all the moral questions? I'm like, There's only ethics, friends. People talk about business ethics and engineering ethics, or, you know, pick it, medical ethics. There's only ethics. Let me simplify it for you. Right and wrong is what you need to focus on, and then you figure out how to apply it. And so for me, with goodness, you may remember the story of Daniel. Do these books still float around? Do you even know what you're looking at here? These were the children Bible story books of Babylon, and it's a dangerous world, and off we haul the valuables out of Jerusalem, and ultimate ideas get hauled off. The next generation gets hauled off. And then Nebuchadnezzar brings in the University of Babylon. You remember the story? You know the story from Daniel? You know, and there's all, and then really, this is the whole story right here, the crisis in the cafeteria. Do you remember the crisis in the cafeteria? This isn't about enough vegan options at breakfast, or, you know, about, you know, you're not serving me properly for lunch. And, you know, this is a huge crisis. And it's because they're going to learn, they're going to enter this world of science and learning, and they realize it's all dedicated to Marduk, right? It's idolatrous, basically. And so this becomes a real crisis for them. And what's fascinating is they put up the resistance. And they say, we want a different kind of education. We want to approach all this differently. And by the way, they'd rather die than go to the wrong university, which is interesting. I mean, they're willing to put their lives on the line for this. And then you get this great Daniel quote. I mean, this is pure gold. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kind. Who gave them the knowledge, by the way? Really interesting. So it shifts. It's God. The king talked with them. He found none equal in every matter of wisdom and understanding, about which the king questioned them. He found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. To me, this is the money story when it comes to all the knowledge and learning that's out there. They still understand Babylonian literature and science and engineering, they get a massively good education. In fact, 10 times better is what the text says. And that's in the eyes not of God, but who says they're 10 times better? Nebuchadnezzar says they're 10 times better. So that what this means is they're getting this massively good education. They're leaning into all the technology, but God is the one who's teaching them. So, which begs the question in the story, what shifted here? It's not engagement with world-class understanding, science. That's not what's changed, although it's gotten better. It's that God is now at the center of it. And I think, I love Ellen White's quote on this in the book Education, character is not the result of accident, that they make this intentional choice to approach all of this learning, but to do so from a perspective of doing the right thing. So what is doing the right thing with AI? I think it goes back to some of those pictures I showed you at the beginning. When the whole job market's turned upside down, are we looking after the least of these? When we see the implications on the physical environment, are we speaking up? When we see how it can be used for violence or destruction, are we aware of that? When we see that it changes a human being's ability to grow and to be healthy because we're sort of relying on this stuff in a way that's unhealthy, are we taking that to account? The moral questions to me aren't actually that complicated. The work is going to be actually doing the things that are necessary to live healthily. So that's one word too. Science, humanity, development, goodness. A couple more real quick and then we'll talk. Resistance. And I'm drawing the word resistance from a Walter Brueggemann, who's an Old Testament scholar who actually passed away just several weeks ago. His book is called Sabbath as Resistance. It's one of my favorite book titles ever. Sabbath as Resistance. And his core argument is here in our own contemporary context of the rat race of anxiety. Of the rat race of anxiety, the celebration of Sabbath is an act of both resistance and alternative. It is resistance because it is a visible insistence that our lives are not defined by production, consumption of commodity goods. The way of mammon, capital, and wealth is the way of commodity. That is the way of endless desire, endless productivity, endless restlessness without any Sabbath. Jesus taught his disciples that they could not have it both ways. And long story short on Brueggemann's book, he's saying to be a Sabbath keeper is to say no technology and production and consumption and doing things faster and more efficiently is not the gospel, is not what's good about life. And Sabbath is saying, which is what we're doing here today, we are stopping. We are slowing life down. Productivity and efficiency is not the God that we're going to worship. And that's exactly what Sabbath is about, is his point, which is to me is really fascinating. So as an Adventist, just because I can work faster because of AI, just because I can, instead of fielding 100 emails a day, I can field 1,000 emails a day. Just because I can write one sermon in a week, now I can write 1,000 sermons in a week. You see what is it? There's no end to it. So the productive qualities of AI are risky. And Sabbath keepers, if anybody, are in this camp of saying, no, we resist this idea that we just work, 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 spend, 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 fast, fast, fast. It slows us down. So I think there's something there. And then, of course, God is the last piece. And that's all these stories in the Bible where God puts technology in check. By the way, you might think of others, but I thought this was really fun to think about. So the Tower of Babel, remember? All the engineering and the science and the progress. And they want to build this great tower. And what happens to it? Of course, God puts an end to that and says, there's somebody bigger here than all the technology. Horse and rider have been thrown into the sea. This is, you know, the Exodus, right? And all the technological and military power. The foolishness of God, wiser than human wisdom. You see this in the New Testament period where God is smarter. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord, this idea that no matter what intelligence comes to us, God is far superior than anything that comes along. So if you believe that the whole of knowledge is smaller than God, and no matter what AI can do, it's always going to be infinitely smaller than God, that takes a lot of stress off this whole conversation, because God is bigger. Okay. And so that I'm not sort of panicked with all of it. Anyway, some of my initial thoughts on AI and how we might think about it. Your thoughts. Are we getting into the controversies now?
No. So you think pastors are using AI for their sermons?
Do I think pastors are using AI? Yes, I do.
Wow. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah. So, I don't know what you all of you should give me. I'm interested in your take. I would never let AI write a talk for me. But would I say to AI, hey, can you give me 10 different interpretations of such and such a passage? Or the other day I said, I would like you to give me a synthesis of what Ellen White, C.S. Lewis, and I had one other thinker think about some passage. And 10 seconds later, I had that research done. Now, you tell me whether I should use that or not. I mean, I'm just saying, because when I went to seminary back in the day, you had to look up Greek in a book, and it was, and now I can, I mean, if I'm using Google, aren't I like a third of the way there already? I don't know. I want to hear your opinions, but I'm like, why would I not use those tools?
So one of the tools that we've been developing at Hope Channel International is a research tool that pastors and church leaders can do to make their thoughts and their ideas more concise. Because what we found is a pastor may have a heart to talk about marriage. And so they think the issues that I need to talk about are divorce. And so they put a whole sermon together because they feel called to talk about divorce, and it lands on deaf ears. Because the real root of the issue in the community was finance. Finance is what was causing the divorce. So if he or she had sat down and used the research tool and searched for marriage, what it does is the research tool searches through metadata in YouTube as well as in Reddit threads. And it does similar type of words assimilation. And then you can actually drill down and see what are people talking about. And if they had used that in that particular region, they would see, oh, there's a lot about finance, and they would drill down. They can even change it to a different region in certain parts of Africa. You do that same search, it'll be about child marriage. So you can tailor what you're doing. We're not trying to replace. That's very different than saying, ChatGPT, write my sermon. But there's tools there to try and make it more concise.
Right. Yeah, good example.
I agree with that. I think it's a tool that we can use to help us with everyday life things. But we shouldn't just like give it that prompt to say, hey, do this for me. But I think we should engage with it in a way that we also put our own like style or flair to it. Because like you said, if you use Google, you're already like a third way there. So it's like the same way you can use AI that way too. And you can verify the sources that it gives you to make sure that it's correct. So I think it's a good tool that we can use, but I don't think we should have it do the work for us. I still think we should think for ourselves. And there's a verse I want to read, kind of going along the lines of the last three verses you shared. So Isaiah 40 verse 15 says, "Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as a small dust in the balance. Behold, he taketh up the islands, and it as a very little thing." So all of AI and all of its intelligence, like you said, like it doesn't compare to the knowledge that God has.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, the truth is, to your earlier point, even if you have a paper Bible that has cross-referencing, the cross-referencing is a cheater already. Does that make sense? So, but I think, yeah, I love the verse that you used. I actually have a whole stack of that I'm building. I'm going to add that to it as well. Yeah, excellent.
There's a fun way to think about generative AI and its kind of role in our lives that comes from academia. And so when we read an article that was written by a professor, what we don't know is that the great majority of the time the professor had research assistants that were working with her or him to generate that content. And, you know, graduate students make excellent research assistants. So the way that I've looked at ChatGPT is as a really great research assistant that I'm paying $20 a month for.
Well, and I won't out any of my professors on this, but no, but I'll say some of them have squawked about students using AI to write papers, right? Which playing by the rules is always an ethical issue. So whatever the rules are, does that make sense? If the rules say this, then those are the rules. But I know that some of our professors are using AI as a to grade papers. But that's kind of the point, though, which is, if you're going to use a human assistant to read it, is it, why would, and I think this is the issue of ethics to me. And the ethics to me are just, I would, like a coach or a referee in a sport, is you have to play by the rules, whatever the rules say. That's what I'm trying to work on. So if the rules say you've got to handwrite all of these papers, it doesn't matter whether you want to use AI or not. But anyway, lots of interesting questions. I think we're about it.
Yeah, so I have an industry example. So I work in the secular world in engineering, and I'll tell you that there's a shortage of people that want to do what I do in manufacturing. So I'm literally like designing a bot so I can use the AI as an accelerant to when I get somebody in that just maybe went through high school, doesn't have a trade, and that person can ramp up within record time period versus me trying to train him or her. It's amazing. So it's a tool.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to add to the point about development that you made earlier, because AI has been around a bit long enough to start having basically retrospective review of it. And I think it was about a month ago, they released reports. A few researchers have released preliminary reports and basically have shown that cognitively, AI, at least from a student standpoint, basically makes kids less cognitively capable. And it's actually to the point that it is a cognitive deficit worse than as if they had never used AI to begin with. So there's like the performance of students, I guess, did learn. And then there's people that are basically controls that didn't even learn anything, so to speak, but the cognitive performance from the students is actually worse than people that have just not touched it to begin with. So that is something I think for, I mean, they look at students, but I think it's something to consider in large scale of, like you mentioned, you know, the stairs and the elevator. But yeah, that is something that I think is.
Now, I was just going to say, I think this is where we might have to think about. So I go to a gym and work out, you know, several times a week. Why do I do that? Because I'm a white collar worker, if you will, and I don't go into the, you know, back 40 behind my house. I don't do physical labor all day for a job. I think it's a little bit like this, that if we're going to use the tools, what is the gymnasium or the workout room for the mind? Does that make sense? I think that's going to be the trick, because I saw that same study and they're even doing some brain imaging where certain parts of the brain are atrophying. Maybe it's similar to what we saw when students are not engaged in writing and some of these things. So I think we do have a retrospective, you're right, already. And it may be that we have to have gymnasiums for the mind just like we have gymnasiums for the body, if that makes sense, right? It's why older people do things like crossword puzzles and, well, apparently play Scrabble, since you all looked at me like.
Well, yeah.
Are we at time? So. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this breakout session presented by Adventist Young Professionals as part of the 2025 Behold Convention. We invite you to explore the other sessions in this series and continue the journey with us.